So if you look at what Statistics Canada reports call unattached women, 40% of unattached women are living below the poverty line. 54% of single mothers in this country are living below the poverty line. 43% of Aboriginal women are living below the poverty line, as are 37% of women of color and 48% of women who are recent immigrants. Those rates are incredibly high, and when we tell them to the CEDAW committee, they're shocked.
Canada had a really hard time answering most of the questions.
Yeah. There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
In March of 2003, the United Nations Committee on Discrimination Against Women severely rebuked British Columbia for rolling back women's equality. The Canadian province had submitted outdated and misleading data to the UN committee, but a coalition of women's groups blew the whistle, submitting a shadow report. As a signatory of CEDAW, the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, Canada must defend its record every 4 years before the CEDAW committee in New York. Sharon McIver, an Aboriginal lawyer and former spokeswoman for the Native Women's Association of Canada, was in New York in January to lobby for the non-governmental report. On March 12, she and other members of the BC CEDAW Coalition spoke to an overflow crowd in Vancouver about their work and its impact.
The experience in New York was very interesting and quite stimulating. The reports that were put out and given to the committee members, I think, made a really big difference in the level of discussion that the committee members had when Canada made their report. We did a lot of one-on-one with the committee. You get a 15-minute spot to make a presentation, but most of our time was spent grabbing an individual, one of the 23 committee members, when they broke for lunch or the end of the day or before the day started or when they got up to go to the bathroom. You just followed them out and stood by the bathroom door waiting for them to come out so you could talk to them when they were going back. And they had read the report and were very well versed on a lot of things that we wanted to tell them before we talked to them. I went specifically about Aboriginal women and the situation of Aboriginal women in Canada. So I was quite pleased not only with the questions that were brought forward, but with the recommendation by the CEDAW committee. And they actually said that, I have it here, the committee is further concerned that the First Nations Governance Act currently under discussion does not address remaining discriminatory legal provisions under the other acts, including matrimonial property rights, status and band membership questions, which are incompatible with the convention. And I was quite pleased they go on to make the recommendations that we had asked them to make. What happens is that Canada sits down, gives a brief overview of their report. Committee members, of which there are 23, then ask questions of Canada, and then Canada gets a chance to respond. They take a break, they ask them more questions, and then Canada gets a chance to respond. And I think there were 33 questions given to Canada, and every one of them very specifically attached to the reports that were made or the conversations that we had. And Canada had a really hard time answering most of the questions. And I think at the end realized that the committee had seen through their report and they wanted specific answers. For the Aboriginal women's part, they are also asking the state party to provide comprehensive information on the situation of Aboriginal women in its next report, which I'm really pleased with. I think that Canada should stand up and talk about what they've done or what they're not doing and be honest about it.
Since the landslide election of the provincial Liberal Party 2 years ago, women of British Columbia have suffered one rollback after another. Loss of the Ministry of Women's Equality, closure of women's centres across the province, massive social service cuts, and union busting throughout the public sector. many of these acts violate the party's own election promises. The United Nations CEDAW Committee called the cuts examples of structural adjustment, the kind of economic reorientation that has been forced on poor countries by the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. British Columbia, however, is one of Canada's richest provinces. The Poverty and Human Rights Project is one of 17 non-governmental organizations in the BC CEDAW Group. Its co-director, Sheila Day, was in New York in January to present the group's report to the UN committee. On March 12, 2003, she told an overflow crowd in Vancouver about the CEDAW committee and what it had to say about British Columbia.
Thanks to everyone for coming tonight. We really want to tell you about this initiative that we've all been engaged in. It's a new and quite exciting initiative. Although Canada is reporting to the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women in 2003 for the fifth time, this is the first time that Canadian women have really been organized and have submitted to that committee our own reports telling what we consider to be the conditions of women in this country and what our situation is right now. And so it's a big step forward for women nationally and a big step for women in British Columbia, who are the only jurisdiction where women got together inside a province and said, we have our own story to tell, and it's a very important one, reflective of what's happening to women across the country, but very important to be told right now. It's my job tonight to try to tell you a little bit about what this process is. What is it we've been doing? And to try to tell you at least some of the core parts of the story that we told to the United Nations. So I've been given the task of talking about the who, what, when, where, why. Although when I look at my notes, I think I'm actually going to tell you about what, who, how, where, when, who, and why. So let me start with what. The core of this is the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. It's so long that we all call it CEDAW, just to make it easier. It's an international human rights treaty negotiated by governments, adopted by the General Assembly of the United Nations in 1979. It's now ratified by 171 countries around the world, which is about 90% of the members of the United Nations. Ratification of the treaty by any particular government means that they agree to comply with the terms of that convention. So they've essentially, first of all, negotiated it among governments. One of the mistakes I think people make is that they think this is some invention of we wild women. It is not. It's a treaty negotiated by governments around the world. The ratification by each country then means that that country itself agrees to be bound by the terms and to comply with those terms. And to make laws and policies at home consistent with the requirements of that treaty. So the convention requires two basic central things. One is it requires the elimination of discrimination against women in all laws. And secondly, it requires the adoption of what the convention calls all appropriate measures to ensure that there will be the full development and advancement of women. Then it's quite specific. It names the areas where this must be done. So it requires elimination of discrimination in politics and public life, in education, in employment, in health, in economic and social life, in citizenship status and family life. It includes rights to equal pay for work of equal value, the right to maternity leave, the right to childcare, and it also sets out the rights very specifically of rural women to access to services and to participate in decisions that will affect them. Ratification also requires what are called states parties. So if you sign on, you become a states party. And it requires states parties to report once every 4 years on their compliance with that treaty. Canada ratified in 1981, and the treaty binds all the levels of government in the country. So there's another, you know, usual mistake that people make. They think it binds the federal government, but it doesn't have to do anything to do with provincial governments. That's not the case under international human rights law. All levels of government are bound when the country signs on as a state. Okay, who do we report to once every 4 years? Well, we report to the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, in other words, the CEDAW Committee. And that committee is nominated and elected by the states' parties to the convention. So the 171 countries that sign on to the convention then nominate and subsequently elect the members of the UN CEDAW Committee. Those committees are sitting as experts. In other words, they're not sitting on the CEDAW Committee as representatives of their governments or of their countries, unlike some other UN bodies. They're called an expert body. They're sitting as experts. They're nominated and elected because of their expertise in the area of women's rights. Some of them are judges. Some of them come out of NGO backgrounds. Some of them are academics. They all have credentials in the area of women's equality and women's rights. How does the review happen? Well, Canada actually writes a report. If you'd like to bore yourself, you could go to the Heritage Canada website and read Canada's report. I know I'm being a little bit flippant, but I say it quite seriously. The unfortunate thing about the reports that Canada does, it does them very conscientiously, they're very thorough in a certain kind of way, but they're mainly window dressing. They're very self-congratulatory, they gloss over problems, they avoid mentioning the things that are really serious difficulties in the country for women, and consequently, they're not, for us anyway, particularly informative. The committee formulates questions based on the written reports they get, Canada answers them in writing, and then, during one of the sessions of the CEDAW committee, Canada actually appears before the committee. It makes a presentation, and then the CEDAW committee members ask questions. This is quite a lively, or this was a very lively, interaction at the CEDAW session this year. So Canada was actually formally reviewed on the 23rd of January at the UN Plaza in New York City. And Canada was asked many, many questions, and we can talk more about the kinds of questions that the CEDAW committee asked. After they've heard the answers to questions, the CEDAW committee then produces concluding comments. And in the concluding comments, you'll see from your copy, they say, here's what the Canadian government said, here are the good things we think are happening in Canada, and here are the things that we're very concerned about and where we think changes have to be made. This report on Canada is highly critical. We've never seen a report from the CEDAW committee that's as critical as this one. If you go back and look at the 97 report, it's very bland by comparison. This report is very critical, and the committee has expressed very serious concerns. Also in the review, non-governmental organizations are permitted to submit reports. And so in this case, there were two major reports submitted by Canadian women's organizations, one by the Feminist Alliance for International Action, which is an alliance of 40 national women's organizations, and the other one by the BC CEDAW Group, which is a coalition, as you've already heard, of about 12 women's organizations in this province. So what's the story that we've told to the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women? We've told the story about how structural adjustment came to Canada and the story of the impacts that that's had on women in the country. So we've talked to the UN committee in our written reports and in our conversations with individual members of the committee about what's happened to the central organizing of social programs in this country and the reduction, the shredding, we might say, of those social programs and why it's of particular significance to women. We told them to pay attention to what's happened to federal-provincial relations with respect to social programs. We took them back to the 1995 Budget Implementation Act and said to them, this is a turning point if you're to understand what's happening to Canadian women. At that point, we got rid of cost sharing, 50-50 cost sharing between the feds and the provinces for certain social programs. We ended the designation of funds being transferred from the feds to the provinces for certain social programs. We took away the right to welfare in this country and the right to an adequate standard of welfare. And then we rolled the transfers from the feds to the provinces up into one big transfer called the Canadian Health and Social Transfer and just shipped it to the provinces with no designations and no conditions attached, no standards any longer, and we cut the size of the transfer at the same time. Now that's essentially put the provinces in the position of being poorer in terms of dollars, but much more flexible, which is what they wanted, in terms of what they can do with respect to providing or not providing social programs to the residents of their province. There is no earmarking attached to those transfers anymore. They can take the money from the federal government and it does not have to be spent on social programs at all. It can be spent on paving roads. Funds that were designated before for social assistance, for civil legal aid, for shelters for battered women, for post-secondary education, for health, for social assistance, including things like home care and so on. There is no designation any longer. And so BC represents in this story a sort of example of what kind of outcome we can have from this new, freer, more flexible arrangement that we have between the federal and provincial governments with respect to social programs.
You're listening to Sheila Day, a lobbyist for the BC CEDAW Group, whose recent shadow report exposed British Columbia's women's rights violations to the UN.
Why is it that cuts to social programs are of particular significance to women? All of this, of course, affects everyone. But there's a reason why we need to say to the United Nations Committee that this has a particular significance for women. And that's because women are not socially and economically equal. And social programs have been, and to the extent that we still have them and we cling to them, they are a central equalizing force in the lives of women. They're an egalitarian in our lives and in our country. Because women are still, even in 2003, assigned the role of principal caregiver for children, for older people, for men, that role affects our employment opportunities, where in the workforce we fit in, we're seen to fit in. It affects our educational opportunities, our economic equality, and our autonomy. Public health care, child care, affordable public education, adequate unemployment insurance, and adequate social assistance have all provided ways of ameliorating women's inequality, reducing its harms, and making more openings and opportunities for women. Some of the burden of caregiving gets shifted from individual women to the state. And women get good jobs in the caregiving sector, jobs that are unionized and have benefits and so on. Women have more opportunities to be involved in paid work, more opportunities to be involved in education, if childcare and public health services are available and affordable. And women's economic vulnerability and dependence on men is softened by access to welfare and unemployment insurance benefits and public pensions. By contrast, when we take these things away, or we shred them, or we reduce them, women lose good jobs, the burden of caregiving gets shifted back onto the shoulders of individual women, we're carrying more unpaid work than before. Many women, and the poorest women of all, are at risk of not being able to feed their children and keep a roof over their heads. So there's a basic security issue at the most fundamental level. Cuts to social programs also harm women because women are poorer than men. And one of the things that's really important and was important in our storytelling to the CEDAW committee is we told them about the poverty of women in Canada. 18% of women are living under the poverty line compared to 13% of men. But particular groups of women also have incredibly high rates of poverty. So if you look at what the Statistics Canada reports call unattached women, 40% of unattached women are living below the poverty line. 54% of single mothers in this country are living below the poverty line. 43% of Aboriginal women are living below the poverty line, as are 37% of women of color and 48% of women who are recent immigrants. Those rates are incredibly high, and when we tell them to the CEDAW committee, they're shocked by those rates. Canada is one of the wealthiest countries in the world, and that's the reflection. Even when women are not below the poverty line, women are still not economically equal, as we all know, right? Women who are working full-time are making 70% of what men are earning. Women get 58% of what men get from the Canada Pension Plan. 40% of women are working in non-standard jobs compared to 29% of men, which means they don't have union protections, they don't have full-time work, they don't have benefits, et cetera, et cetera. And they're not going to have pensions. So even there, when we go beyond the poverty rates, we still got women who are economically unequal. Then we add to that cuts to social programs that take away services that women are relying on to fill in gaps. We reduce subsidies for programs like daycare that women really need. We increase the user fees for things like health services and pharmacare. And women haven't got the same incomes to absorb all of that increased cost and lack of services that were there before. Women are hit the hardest, and the most vulnerable groups of women are hit hard and in particular ways that have to do with their particular vulnerabilities. Because they're recent immigrants, or because they have disabilities, or because they're elderly. What's the response of the committee to this central part of our story? They know everything about structural adjustment. They have seen structural adjustment in 171 countries, right? This is nothing new to them. The peculiarities of Canada are a little, you know, like federal, provincial, territorial relations are a little complicated to figure out. But structural adjustment is like a story they've been told too many times. They understand that what they're watching is the Canadian version of the formulas that are being peddled by the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, other international financial institutions, and we're doing the same thing. Canada's doing it, BC's now doing it in spades, and this is what we get. And it harms women. So they know that. And it was, I can't tell you, there was, it was sort of comforting. It's a hard story to tell, but it's comforting to know that you're talking to people who actually understand what it is you're talking about, and that the next step they understand too, that it harms women. They get that. What they're amazed by, as I've already said, is they cannot believe the rates of poverty and economic inequality in a country as rich as this. They asked over and over again to representatives of Canada for information about poverty, particular groups of women living in poverty in Canada. And one of the things that they said, they actually say it in their report, is why is it that Canada seems to have anti-poverty strategies that are directed at children, but not directed at women? And don't you think you better think about this again? They're very concerned about the federal government's failure to ensure that the terms of the treaty can be lived up to consistently in all the jurisdictions across the country. And they say to the federal government, please find new or old ways to make sure that women can rely on consistency in Canada. And one of the ways, they say, is please go back and reconsider your fiscal arrangements, because giving up conditionalities, that is, giving up attaching strings to the transfers of money from the feds to the provinces, has left you without one of your best tools to establish standards that women in every jurisdiction can rely on. And finally, they also say BC deserves special criticism. It's the only province that's singled out. Quebec, I should say, not quite. Quebec gets singled out for praise for its childcare program, right? You know, Quebec has put in place a very affordable, accessible childcare program, universal, etc. Quebec gets singled out for praise. BC gets singled out for criticism. And this is, I have to say, highly unusual. And so they have said to BC, they're very concerned, that's what that paragraph is up there, they're very concerned about the disproportionate negative impact on women of recent changes and cuts in the province of British Columbia, including cuts to welfare, changed eligibility rules for welfare, cuts to legal aid, changes to the status of the Ministry of Women's Equality, closures of courthouses, change to the domestic violence policy, and cuts in services to violence against women. It's clear from the way the paragraph is structured, this is not a closed list as far as they're concerned. They're giving these as examples, but they're saying we're concerned about the impact of these recent cuts. And they say to British Columbia, better look at this again and change what needs to be changed here.
Sheila Day of the Poverty and Human Rights Project and Aboriginal lawyer Sharon McIver spoke in Vancouver, Canada on March 12, 2003. Their talks were recorded for Resistor Radio by Robin Kelly. I'm Rosemary Collins, reporting for Wings.
For more about Wings, check our website, www.wings.org, or email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks our supporters, including Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.